Well, it's great to be back with you this morning. I had the month of August off, and I just want to say a big thank you to those who came and spoke during that month. I really appreciate it. It was great to have a break. We spent the middle 2 weeks here in Victoria entertaining family, and the first week we're up in the Black Creek, Campbell River area, and the last week we were up there again. I did some fly fishing in the Campbell River. I went fishing with Steve Karadimas. Some of you remember Steve. He was our youth ministry intern. He's a youth pastor in Campbell River now, and we were fishing, and he rebaptized me in the Campbell River. That is a story for another day. We don't have time this morning, but it was a great experience, and it was just good to be away and enjoy time with my family. One of the things I do on holidays is just one of the things I like to do every morning when I'm on holidays. I like to seek out a newspaper or two and a good cup of coffee and sit and read the newspapers and just get caught up and enjoy reading them without having to rush through. But as I read the newspapers during the month of August, I thought to myself, man, this world's messed up. There is so much that's gone on. You know, never mind the Senate scandal, but all the stuff, the shootings, the sex scandals, the Middle East. And I was reading this, and one day I thought to myself, wow, this is crazy. And I thought to myself, more importantly, as I thought, this is crazy, I thought, how are we as Christ followers supposed to live in this messed up world? And so this week and next week, I'm doing a two-part series called Thy Kingdom Come. Now, here's the deal. It's two parts, so you need to be here next week, because otherwise you're going to go away really messed up today, all right? So you're going to go away all depressed today, because I'm probably going to offend most people here, but next week, come back. And if you know people that are coming next week that aren't here this week, tell them to listen to the sermon. All right? Tell them to go on. And if you can't be here next week, make sure you listen on Sanage's website to the sermon. In Isaiah 5 in the Old Testament, the prophet Isaiah shares six indictments against the nation of Israel. And these indictments are six specific sins that God was going to judge the nation of Israel for. And as I read these newspapers this summer, and I asked myself, what is going on? And then as I read through Isaiah chapter 5, it became apparent to me that these indictments spoken thousands of years ago to the nation of Israel apply to our nation and our culture in the Western world today. And as I read Isaiah 5, I began to realize that these indictments, we're going to look at five of them quickly this morning, really explain to us why things are the way they are. So let me start by reading Isaiah chapter 5, verse 8. I'm going to be using the Message paraphrase this morning because I believe Eugene Peterson puts this so well. Doom to you who buy up all the houses and grab all the land for yourselves, evicting the old owners, posting no trespassing signs, taking over the country, leaving everyone homeless and landless. What was happening in Isaiah's days were the rich were wanting to possess everything in sight. They were acquiring land however they could, regardless of the impact on others. They were driven to acquire more and more. Their desire was to build large mansions on massive farm estates. Now, that doesn't happen today, does it? People here are not driven to acquire more and more in our culture. Well, when you think about it, our culture is all about accumulating more. And today, things are the way they are because we live in a culture that is bent on getting more and more stuff. We live in a culture that is defined by the pursuit of more. Now, let me be clear this morning, lest you misunderstand. Wealth is not the issue. The issue is the priority we place on accumulating more and more money and possessions at the cost of more important other things. The reality today is that in Canada, consumption wins out over compassion. And if you doubt me, this Christmas we'll spend $35 billion with a B dollars on Christmas stuff, consuming more and more, while it would only take $13 billion with a B dollars to give everyone in the world clean drinking water. Consumption over compassion, doubt me? I was shocked this week when I was driving to work. CFAX 1070 had its daily poll, and the question was this: should Canada allow more Syrian refugees into our country? And they said that 56% of people in Victoria said no. That's repulsive. At least I think it's repulsive. Has your heart not been broken this week by the Syrian refugee crisis, the greatest refugee crisis since World War II? And I look and I hear Germany's taking 800,000 refugees, and Canada, well, we'll take 10,000 over 3 years. Yeah, like we don't have enough space. And here's the deal. We as a church need to respond to that. We can't sit by and see pictures of kids drowning and sit by and say, well, that's a European problem. No, it's a Saanich Baptist Church problem. And we need to respond. And we are working on a response. And next week, we're going to give you some more information on how we as a church can practically respond in some small way to a large humanitarian crisis. But apparently in Victoria, the majority in this poll anyway say, no thanks. Because consumption wins out over compassion. The hard truth is, in Canada, though we like to think we're a compassionate people, the truth is we're more concerned about consuming more and more than we are showing compassion to others. Now, there's a reason for this. And the reason is this. In Canada, we've believed the lie that getting more and more will bring lasting fulfillment. And we've unwittingly adopted a worldview that assumes our needs can be met ultimately by accumulating more and more stuff. Thus, we're all about getting more and bigger and better. And so just like the rich Israelites, some today will do whatever it takes to get more, no matter what the impact on others. Now, intuitively, you would think that people have as much as us and are as wealthy as us would be super happy. But study after study shows that we're not happy. In fact, study after study shows that we're becoming more unhappy. The truth is, materialism has bred to discontentment and disillusionment and disappointment. And here's one of the reasons why. I don't know if you ever thought about this. But people can get so caught up in the pursuit of money and stuff that it prevents them from addressing the issues in their lives which will lead to real happiness. Inner issues, relational issues, spiritual issues. We're too busy, driven, trying to get more and more that we never have time or we never stop to address the real issues that will bring lasting fulfillment. Here's the second indictment. Isaiah 5 verse 11 says this: doomed to those who get up early and start drinking booze before breakfast, who stay up all hours of the night drinking themselves into a stupor. They make sure their banquets are well furnished with harps and flutes and plenty of wine, but they have nothing to do with the work of God. Pay no mind to what he is doing. What Isaiah is talking about here is the fact that Israel was pursuing pleasure on a national scale. Do we here in Canada pursue pleasure on a national scale? Well, one of the best ways to tell your culture's priorities is to examine what it rewards. So, who makes the most money in our North American culture? Entertainers and sports figures, right? Yeah. Think of Miami Marlins, the player Juan Carlos Stanton. Here's a baseball player. He hits a baseball. He signed a 13-year contract for $325 million. That's a lot of money. Do you understand what I'm saying? People who make us feel good, people who entertain us in our culture, make the most money. Now again, sports and entertainment are not the issue. The issue is the priority that is expressed by our reward system. And today things are the way they are because we live in a pleasure-bent culture. And here's the problem with that. Because of that, we're encouraged to think of ourselves first. Our pleasure, our happiness is most important. You see, today we believe the lie that our personal pleasure, our happiness should be our highest values. The fact that I have pleasure, the fact that I'm happy needs to be my highest value. And so if you're not happy, bail out. If you're not happy with your marriage, bail out because your happiness is the highest value. So don't work on the issues. Just go find a new life with a new wife. Or join the 37 million people who have signed up with Ashley Madison, whose motto is life is short, have an affair. And if you've been watching the news, you know that some hackers leaked the millions of names on the site, the database, into the public domain. And you know what shocked me about the whole Ashley Madison thing? Was people were really freaked out that their names were out there. They had a right to be. That isn't good to do that hacking. I'm not saying that was a good thing. But I didn't hear or read anything about the fact that Ashley Madison's existence in our culture is not a good thing. Somehow that got missed because, you see, pleasure is our highest value. And listen, those whose passion is pleasure will be impoverished above all else. Because pleasure substitutes a quick feeling for real, deep, lasting fulfillment. Thus, when pleasure is pursued at all costs, lasting fulfillment is lost. Here's the third one. See why you need to come back for part two, right? Okay, you're catching it now. And I haven't even got to the good stuff yet. Okay, Isaiah 5, verse 18, it says this, "Doom to you who use lies to sell evil, who haul sin to market by the truckload, who say, 'What's God waiting for? Let him move on so we can see it. Whatever the Holy of Israel has cooked up, we'd like to check it out.'" In Isaiah's day, Israel had become a nation that was mocking God, that was choosing to live in open sin without conscience or shame. And unfortunately, what was true for Israel is also true for our nation. Today, things are the way they are because we live in a culture that has lost its sense of shame. Have you noticed a shift and the way people look upon selfish, anti-social, immoral acts? In the past, in our culture in North America, when you did an anti-social, immoral act, you felt guilt, you felt shame, you felt remorse. But today, people not only flaunt those acts, not only do those acts, they flaunt those acts. Now, let me be clear. The change is not in the acts themselves. The acts have been around all through human history. The change is how we in culture react to that kind of behavior. Today we applaud people who openly sin. Don't believe me? Look at the topics on the talk shows this week. People share and the audience cheers. There's no longer shame for clearly wrong behavior. In fact, we're told today, and you read it on Christian blogs, you shouldn't feel shame. Says who? If you do something wrong, you should be ashamed of yourself. You should feel shame. Now, here's the deal. That feeling of shame should motivate you to get right with God and to get right with others and to become a healthy you. And if you don't deal with shame, you'll end up hating yourself. That's not good. That's not good. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't feel shame when you do wrong, immoral acts. Where there is no shame for wrong, violence and perversion and abuse abound. Now, as Canadians, we say that society should be inclusive and accept all people. Absolutely, I'm there. I agree. Don't misquote me. That's true. But that doesn't mean we should accept bad behavior. Yet in the name of acceptance and tolerance, we've come to think that we need to accept the individual and their wrong behavior. Some of you guys may recognize this next guy coming up on the screen here. That's Josh Duggar from 19 Kids and Counting. He's a Christ follower. He's the eldest of the 19 children. And may it became public that when he was 14 or 15 years old, he molested 5 girls. 4 of them were his sisters. It came out later that he had a porn addiction, that he had joined the Ashley Madison website to cheat on his wife. All the while, he was a pro-family activist involved with the Family Research Council. All right? And I read a couple of blogs written by Christ followers who said we shouldn't judge him. Well, I guess that depends on what you mean by judging. You see, today in our culture, we believe the lie that you can't say something is wrong. We believe the lie that you can't challenge wrong behavior. We believe the lie that you can't judge someone or something. Folks, those are lies from the evil one that will lead to relational and societal destruction. Who says we shouldn't judge? In 2 Timothy 4:2, Paul tells Timothy, rebuke, reprove, exhort. In 1 Thessalonians 5:14, he says, admonish the unruly. In Ephesians 5:11, he tells the church, do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. And I know some of you are saying, yeah, but in Matthew 7, Jesus said, just not, judge not, lest you be judged. Right, he did say that. But can I read you the whole of what Jesus said there? Matthew 7 Verses 1 to 5, it says this, do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Jesus is commenting in these verses on how to judge. He's not forbidding it. He's condemning hypocritical judgment in which a person judging has done a poor job of making judgments about their own life, and yet thinks he's an expert at judging the same problems in another person's life. It's like you having lunch with someone if you're a businessman and you're all involved in unethical business dealings and you're challenging your friend across the table to clean up his business act. Jesus says, no, 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 no. Don't do that. But here Jesus says that once a person is able to make judgments about his own life, then he is confident to take the speck out of someone else's life. See, Here's the deal for Christ followers. We throw the pendulum out too far on either side. We're to speak the truth with love. And what's happened in the past is we've spoken the truth, but we've had no love. And when you speak the truth without love, you come off like a jerk. You come off self-righteous. But today we've taken the pendulum and we've thrown it all the way over here and we go, we got to love and not speak the truth. Sometimes the most loving thing to do is speak the truth. If you're a parent, you know that. Here's a great verse. A couple of them. 1 Corinthians 13:14 says, be on guard, stand firm in the faith, be courageous, be strong. That's the truth part. And then I love to look. Do everything in love. Do everything in love. And sometimes the most loving thing you can do is say to somebody, you know, you're on the path to destruction. But we live in a culture that says you can't judge. You can't say something is wrong. Here's the next one. Isaiah 5:20. Doom to you who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness in the place of light and light in the place of darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Things are the way they are today because we live in a culture of confusion. Rationalism, relativism have become key values today. What is right for you is right for you. What is right for me is right for me. That's your truth, but it's not my truth. There are no absolutes. By the way, when someone says that to you, you can tell them they're making an absolute statement because they are. Or if someone says to you, there is no truth, you can say, when you say there is no truth, you're making a true statement that there is no truth. You'll get that one. And today, like the Israelites, we've turned our backs on God. In the Western world, we've removed his principles from our culture, and I would suggest to you, you might not agree with me, I would suggest to you that we've, because of that, lost our moral compass. See, God gave us some values to live by. They're called the Ten Commandments. And let me read them to you. It's just to remind you what they say. Exodus 20, it says this. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Honor your father and your mother so they may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now think about those commands that I just read to you for a moment. The Ten Commandments, when you think about it, are the lowest possible standard for humane living. I mean, consider what they call us to. Can you stop killing each other? Can you not steal each other's stuff? It would be really helpful if you wouldn't lie to one another. Could you not take other people's husbands or wives, but maybe just keep your own? The Ten Commandments, folks, call us to stop dehumanizing one another. Anything, if you think about it, anything below these standards is choosing to live like an animal. And God gave us values for a healthy society, but today in the Western world, we've chosen to turn from those values because we believe the lie that we don't need God today and we don't need his values. How's that working out for us? I mean, when you think about it, When you think about it, our thinking has become so perverse that we've reversed right and wrong and good and evil. And I don't know if you followed the Planned Parenthood thing with the videos. I won't go into detail. It'll bother some of you. But we've lost our compass. January 13th, Mary Elizabeth Williams, a very, underlined, very pro-choice person, wrote an article entitled, "So What If Abortion Kills Life?" Let me just read a little bit of this to you. "I believe," she says, "that life starts at conception." Now, she's pro-choice, right? "I believe that life starts at conception," she says, "and it's never stopped me from being pro-choice. I know throughout my own pregnancies, I never wavered for a moment in the belief that I was carrying a human life inside of me. I believe that's what a fetus is, a human life. And that doesn't make me one iota less solidly pro-choice. Here's the complicated reality in which we live. All life is not equal. That's a difficult thing for liberals like me to talk about, lest we wind up looking like death panel loving, kill your grandma and your precious baby stormtroopers. Yet a fetus can be a human life without having the same rights as the woman in whose body it resides. She's the boss. Her life and what is right for her circumstances and her health should automatically trump the rights of the non-autonomous entity inside her always. And I would put the life of the mother over the life of the fetus every single time, even if I still need to acknowledge my conviction that the fetus is indeed a life worth sacrificing." Do you see what's happening there? Here's what's happening here. It's the exaltation of self. It's the exaltation of self. I'm in control. It's my body. I'm my own God. And just a thought here. Not everyone will agree with me on this. The baby is in the woman's body, but the baby is not the woman's body. It has its own DNA. It has its own functioning organs. The baby is in the woman's body, but the baby is not the woman's body. And so when you hear the, it's my body, it's the exaltation of self. And what we've done as a culture is we've rationalized murder for the sake of convenience. And that is what happens when a culture believes the lie that they don't need God or his values. One more. Probably be glad when I'm done these. 521 says, doom to you who think you're so smart, who hold such a high opinion of yourselves. Things are the way they are because just like the Israelites, we believe that we're smarter than God. And because of that, today we believe the lie that our own wisdom is enough. Again, how's that working for us? Now, here's the bottom line. The bottom line is none of this should surprise us. That as we look at society and we say the indictments of Isaiah apply to our culture today very clearly, it shouldn't surprise us because we live in a culture, in a Western world, that it's turned its back largely on God. Thus, we shouldn't expect unredeemed people to live redeemed lives. And so the real question for us, here's the real question. The real question is, as Christ followers, how should we then live? That's the question. Recently, I read an article in Relevant magazine, and I want to read you a bit of the article this morning as we begin to wrap up. This is how the article read. A few years ago, I read a story that has haunted me ever since. It was a first-hand account from a young man who grew up in Nazi Germany. He considered himself a Christian and was part of a small church that gathered every Sunday to worship together. The church had heard rumors about what was happening to the Jewish people, but they mostly tried to ignore the stories. They felt so powerless to stop the Nazi machine. The only distinguishing thing about this church is that it had been built a little too close to the train tracks. And lately, the trains have been running a lot, but the problem wasn't the train, it was the cargo. In this little church building, the German Christians could hear the sound of the Jewish people on those trains. They could hear the train whistle as it would begin to approach, immediately followed by men and women screaming for help as it went barreling toward the Nazi death camp. These church people had hearts. So the screams, they tormented them. They knew they had to do something, but they believed nothing they could do would make a difference. So over time, they learned the schedule of the train. And they planned to start singing hymns to keep from hearing the loud cries from the doomed people rushing right past their walls. The author goes on. It's easy to feel disgust at this cowardly church, but I'm sure this happens on some level every Sunday across the world. It doesn't happen intentionally, but we have both participated in and seen worship that ignores the suffering of the world and tries to escape from God's call for us to participate in it. It's not just churches that try to escape the world. On an individual level, we numb ourselves because when we don't, we can hear those screams. When Jesus started his church, he took 12 disciples to a city known as having religious orgies to celebrate the god Pan. The city was Caesarea Philippi, and it was there that Jesus said to his disciples, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Jesus went to a place where all hell was breaking loose, and he declared that his church was going to be a powerful force, that it would have the authority and the power to press into the places of darkness, and the kingdom of darkness would not be able to prevail against it. So instead of singing louder to dry out the cries of the hurting, maybe we need to allow those cries to transform what we sing, how we live, how we talk, how we pray. Jesus said, pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. In other words, God, bring up there, down here into our lives, into our businesses, into our families, into our cities, into our world. What would that look like? Well, that's next week, and that's why you need to come back. Because I've left you down this morning, but I want to pick you up next week because we're the people of hope. You know why we're the people of hope? Because of this table. See, it all starts right here on the table. If it wasn't for what these elements represent, the situation would have been hopeless. But the bread and the cup speak of what Jesus did on the cross, and because what he did on the cross, we can have a restored relationship with him, and because of that, we can become kingdom people, and because of that, we can be kingdom bringers. We can go out into society, and we can make a difference. But it all starts right here, because it all starts with your and my relationship with Jesus. When we know Jesus, as I said at the AGM, the things that break his hearts will begin to break our hearts. When we know Jesus, we'll look out and we'll see what I've been talking about this morning, and we'll weep and we'll go, things don't have to be that way. We can go out and make a difference in the name of Jesus. But it all starts here with our relationship with Jesus, with acknowledging and worshiping what he's done for us so we can go out with him to make a difference in the lives of others. And so this morning, we're going to take the bread, we're going to take the cup now. As we do so, I want you to reflect on what Jesus has done for us, what Jesus has done for the world, and reflect on your relationship with him. Maybe this morning you need to get right with him. Maybe this morning there's things in your life. Maybe you're pursuing more and more instead of pursuing more and more of Jesus. Maybe there's something I said this morning that's tweaked you and you just need to get right with Jesus. Now's the time. As we worship him, as we acknowledge his sacrifice, let his spirit speak to us. And so we're going to take the bread, we're going to take the cup. If you're a follower of Jesus, you're visiting with us, you're more than welcome to participate with us. We hand out the bread, we take it all together, we hand out the cup, we take it all together. Let me pray. And then those that are serving can come on up to the front. Father, thank you. Thank you that even as we look at culture and we see how messed up it is, we know that we're a redeemed people that are called to go out into culture. We're called to be light in darkness. But the only reason we can do that is because of what this table represents, your sacrifice for us, so that we can go out and sacrifice for others. And so this morning, Lord, as we take the bread, as we take the cup, as we reflect, may your spirit speak to us. May your spirit this morning allow us just to see the love that was behind all this. God, I just pray this morning in this room that these moments will be special in a holy way. In Jesus' name, amen.